Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Helles Foundation. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Victor Harris, Rachel Brenlin, and Jeffrey Ehrenreich, creators of the beautiful book Fire in the Hole, the spirit work of Fai Yai Yai and the Mandingo Warriors. Since 2004, the Neighborhood Story Project has been exploring the diverse culture of New Orleans through collaborative ethnography and bookmaking. The latest project is a gorgeous book called Fire in the Hole, the spirit work of Fai Yai Yai and the Mandingo Warriors. With us in the studio today are Victor Harris of Fai Yai Yai, anthropologist Rachel Brenlin of the Neighborhood Story Project, and Jeffrey David Ehrenreich of UNO, who took the photographs for this gorgeous book. So welcome, Rachel, Victor, Jeffrey.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Well, congratulations on this beautiful book. I'm curious to know how it began, how long you've been working on it. Who'd like to start?
So we've been working on the book technically for 19 years because I've been taking photographs of Victor and the group for 19 years. But the actual production of the book, I'm not sure how many years, Rachel. How many do you think it's been at this point?
I think we started in 2012.
Yeah, that sounds about right. So 6 years. I've been taking the pictures and have become the photographer of this group.
The
official photographer. Of course, there are hundreds of other people taking pictures of Victor because the beauty of his suits is just so obvious that people just are drawn to it like a magnet. They just see him in the street and they know to go to him immediately and they all want to take pictures with him. And he's very gracious in the street.
Well, he's very gracious everywhere. I saw you in the lobby and I was ready to go right to you. So, Victor, what did you think when you thought about putting your life into a book?
I never really gave it any thought, you know, because it's just something that I do. And I never really thought about being in a book or anything like that. But when I found out this was happening, I thank Rachel for sure. I think Coach was living when we first started. Oh, yeah. So he died in 2011. So
right.
We have to at least started on that book at 2011 because he was part of the book during that time.
And talk a little bit about Coach, whose spirit is everywhere in this book.
Coach is one of the guys. I mean, without him, I don't know where I would be right now. Like I said, he stood at my table 42 years. I mean, and Coach was everything. He wasn't just a sewer. You know, he was my commissioner at the sewing table. Later on in life, he moved up to be my ambassador. Coach was just about everything. He was a hilarious guy. I mean, he would keep everybody laughing and he'd bring information that you needed, you know. Mm-hmm. So he would seek out all the knowledge and information and come back and tell the chief. That's what was so great about Coach, you know. You know, you could rely on a guy like that. He was a wonderful person.
And his name was Collins Lewis.
Collins Anthony Lewis.
Yes.
If I might add, Coach was the kind of person who could be as funny and as charming as anybody, but who also understood the politics and the interpersonal relationships that people engage in. And so in many ways, he was a guardian, not just of the groove, as they say, but of this particular group and of Victor's back in particular. Nobody will ever replace the way Coach was able to do that.
And I love the way he said, it's better to be the kingmaker than to be the king. Which I thought was so smart.
Although Mel Brooks said it's good to be king.
It is good to be king. Yes, that's true. Now, as this book describes, Fai Yai Yai and the Mandingo Warriors began in a time of great change and a time when you'd experienced some real pain in your life, Victor. And yet you have become, over the years, this figure of healing for your community. So would you talk a little bit about that journey from the beginning?
Yeah, I will. I had to overcome that pain, though. But, you know, like I said, it's was a misfortune, unfortunate thing that happened to me with the tribe, and it was unjustifiable. And they found me guilty of selling the tribe out, I guess they said, and they voted me out of the tribe. And I guess that's where the journey really started, because from that point I was lost and didn't have any knowledge of what I was going to do, because it was a blow to my heart and my mind and my spirit and my soul when that happened, because, you know, those guys was the only people that I ever knew, the only tribe that I ever had. I'd never been with another tribe before. Matter of fact, I inherited this tribe. I was born and raised into it, and I was always in the community. Like I said, Chief Tootie Montana, Allison Chief Tootie Montana was my chief. God bless him, and you know, I love him today. I still love him because he was a great and honorable person. But after, you know, they abandoned me from the tribe, wow, it was a lot of friction going on, you know, so.
And you have this wonderful description of what a lot of people experience when they have a dark moment in life or a dark night of the soul, how you took this time to yourself to be very solitary, to think about what you wanted to do. When you describe unplugging everything, that silence.
Yeah, well, that was the part when I was just lost. I mean, I couldn't even find myself. I was lost. And so the only person who was left was God. God was the only one who could save myself, you know. And that's what I did. That night, I made sure that before I turned off all of the lights, I pulled a plug out the refrigerator, the TV, I stopped the clock from ticking. I didn't want to hear a sound in the house because, you know, I want to be in a spiritual move in the dark with God. And so that's what I did, and I turned off all of the lights, every light in the house, and I was home all alone too. And I just held my head up and I looked up and I started asking God, how could something like this happen to me? Why, God? Please let me know. Tell me how and why did this happen to me? You know, we always ask why things happen. And so those were my words. And, you know, I asked the Lord to give me a sign, talk to me, speak to me. And I actually looking for God to actually talk to me, just like we're in here speaking to each other right now. Mm-hmm. And, well, that didn't happen. So I just waited and waited, and I didn't get no sign and no answer. And so I just slid down the back of the wall in the kitchen where I was at. And I just kneeled down like Sitting Bull with my leg crossed and slid all the way down the wall like that. And wow, I started crying, really actually crying. And I went to sleep crying. And I guess that next morning I woke up, well, you know, something had come over me because I was flexing and stretching my arms, you know, and I was just saying, yeah, and I'm hearing that, and that, you know, because the word was never mentioned before, you know.
Uh-huh.
And I'm hearing something, I'm saying, and I raised my eyebrow, and I said, fire. I said it again, a little louder. I said, fire. Wow, that felt good. You know, it felt great. And then the third time, man, I just crunched my fists together and I squeezed them together as tight as I can and I screamed it out loud as possible. And I said, fire! And I held it. And from that moment, I became the spirit of fire. And I felt the spirit, the chill bumps was all up and down my arms and everything. And boy, I felt so wonderful. And, you know, just that idea come to me. You know, when I thought I didn't have any more friends left, when the spirit of fire yah came into me, man, I couldn't wait to get out of the house to go to tell my family something was wrong with me, honestly, because they said, well, why are you acting like that? What's wrong with you? And I told them about the spirit of fire yah, and they said, what are you talking about, fire yah? I say the spirit of fire yah, that God have given me, you know, a given spiritual cultural name. And mm-hmm. He wants me to do this and he asked me to do that. So we go mass. He said, they were telling me it was too late to mass because it was about 3 months before Mardi Gras. And there was no way possible that you could make the quality suits that we do in 3 months. But, you know, I asked the guys and everybody, I said, look, I gathered up everybody. I have a large family, really.
Yes.
You know, and friends too. Because that's what my tribe was consist of, family and friends that made up half of the neighborhood. And really, and I was, you know, just explaining to them what we're going to do and how we're going to do things. And they said, well, man, it's too late. I said, it's not ever too late, never too late. I said, let's just try. I said, if you just do as I ask you, that's all I could expect of you. you know.
And they did.
And they did.
And magic happened.
It was magic. You know, I had people working in the house like never, ever before. You know, it was something about the spirit of Fire Yah and, well, who I was in the neighborhood from the beginning. Everyone knew who I was, you know. Mm-hmm. And they know the type of person I was. And I had a lot of friends. And when they heard about it, I'm telling you, like never, ever before, people came to my house day and night. They wouldn't leave my home for 3 months, half of them, mm-hmm. day and night. And I had 3 rooms, a kitchen and a bath and a hallway, and each and every inch of the house would cover with people.
Sewing,
like that, never. Yeah. And I have never had that again, never before, you know.
Well, that's the real spirit work you're talking about in this book, that gathering of family and friends in your tribe. And you've masked with so many of your family as well. You've masked with your daughter, your grandson, right?
Yeah, we went through generations. My daughter, I got grandkids, and I even have the last one was just made a year old. Mm-hmm. So it's been quite a while I've been doing that, but I am the voice of the family that ever, you know, mass as a Mardi Gras Indian.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, such power in it. Now, Rachel, so many other cultural institutions are part of this book. We learn so much about the Backstreet Cultural Museum, the Northside Skull and Bone Gang, Tambourine and Fan, the list just goes on and on. So you give us this wonderful surround of Mardi Gras Indian culture as well.
Yeah, that was one of the things that through the life history work that we did with Victor and the other guys in Faya Yah, and then looking through Jeffrey's photography and Sylvester's collection at the Backstreet, we wanted to pull together the institutions that had helped create and support Victor and the other people who are involved in the Mandingo Warriors, because that's why they do it to a certain extent, mm-hmm. right, is to have this kind of reciprocity and call and response between different places and organizations. And, you know, there's a lot of peer-to-peer respect that goes on in the culture. And that's one of the things that I really value, is the kind of co-creativity that occurs and that people create these institutions in our neighborhoods for each other.
So tell us about some of the other voices in this book, like Sylvester Francis, for example.
Sylvester Francis started the first grassroots museum dedicated to African-American performance traditions in New Orleans, and he's inspired many who have followed, but he was the first one, and he's had a very long-term collaboration with Victor. Victor was the first one to donate something to the museum, mm-hmm. and he inspired others to want to donate other things, which has grown and grown over the years. And they do a lot of productions together. Like when Victor's had anniversary parades, Sylvester's the one who's put them on, and he has been documenting them for a long time. Jeffrey also was the president of the Backstreet Board for a number of years, so it made sense to produce it together,
right?
So that we could show the reciprocity that goes on there. And every year on Carnival, Victor comes by, and that's one of the things that everybody looks forward to. For the book release, we co-hosted the event with the Backstreet, and they hosted a parade as well.
So I have to say, you don't leave out the ladies in this book. You have some remarkable queens in this book too, Victor.
Yeah, one is Kim Boutee. That's my niece, one of my older sister's daughter.
She is adorable.
Yeah. Well, we have Cinnamon Black, and she's the first Faya Yah voodoo queen. She's also a baby doll. We have Sula. Sula is, yeah, voodoo mm-hmm. priestess too. And I have, then I have my kids, my grandkids, Kelsey. I have Adrian, my grandson. If I keep naming them, the show probably would have to last an hour, honestly.
I wish we could, though. Now, one of the strong points of this book that will be so revelatory to people, I think, are the year-by-year chronicles. There are chapters from 2006 to 2017, each devoted to a different color, which makes this book this gorgeous rainbow of a thing. So tell us about 2012, the year of Bumpy Blue, which was such a meaningful year for the tribe.
I think that was my hardest year, you know, because that's my first year without him. So mm-hmm. And it's really hard to describe that, because without him, I mean, it was just a big part of me missing. I tried to carry on out his orders because I know what he wanted me to do. You know, he wanted me to keep the spirit alive and carry out the orders. But it was very hard without Coach, honestly.
And part of so much of what you all write about, particularly in the introduction to this book, is honoring your ancestors, all of you, anthropologists as alike, you know? And that must have been very meaningful to you, Victor, to know you were doing that on Coach's behalf, in his honor.
Yeah, well, he deserved that, you know. Like we said earlier, Coach was such a beautiful person, so I don't think there was more than enough we could have done for Coach. Like I said, every time I hear his name, I get emotional. Mm-hmm.
And people who read that chapter will get emotional right along with you.
Sometimes when Victor is talking, he will literally channel Coach's voice, and you can hear the tones and the inclinations of what Coach might be saying in Victor's voice, and it's always clear that he's really channeling Coach when he does it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there are things that when we're in a room sewing, you know, everybody, the guys at the table, Mr. Jack Robertson, Robert, and a few other guys, and we'd be just laughing and talking, and someone would knock over some beads, right? And then we know Coach is in the house.
Right.
Coach would always play with the beads. He just had a habit just listening to the beads and playing with them, whatever he was doing, and he would always build the beads over, I mean, thousands of them, too. So he's watching over us.
So, Jeffrey, talk a little bit about putting together that year-by-year chronology with your photographs, because you've taken thousands of photographs, I'm sure.
Rachel tells me the number is much more than I had imagined. But I've been walking with Victor in all of the events that he does whenever possible, and I've tried to be there whenever it was possible for me. And to be truthful, it's very easy to take pictures of Mardi Gras Indians when they want you to take pictures of them. And he makes every photographer who takes pictures look good, as do the other members of the group. Mm-hmm. So I've been here. I decided that this was the group I wanted to work with for a number of reasons, not the least of which is that Victor has brought the tradition back to African roots and African identity. Victor is outspoken and clear about the fact that what he's doing has its roots in his African identity. And I noticed that the first time I saw him in the street. And it was very clear to me that he was doing something not totally different, but somewhat different than everybody else. Mm. And it was special.
And certainly distinctive and recognizable.
Distinctive and recognizable. Victor is an artist of the first caliber. He's an astounding artist, and the work that he does belongs in museums. It's amazingly beautiful and amazingly interesting and amazingly spiritual all at the same time.
So, Rachel, talk a little bit about how books like this fit into the Neighborhood Story Project, which brings so many great New Orleans books to life.
Well, the Neighborhood Story Project is based in the 7th Ward, which is Victor's neighborhood, too. So we have had kind of an ongoing collaboration with Jeffrey and Victor over the years as we've done smaller projects. And I believe in grassroots educational models, and I've learned a lot as a teacher that way. So when I was teaching at John McDonough Senior High, a lot of my students went to tambourine and fans programs, mm-hmm. and I learned a lot about how to take the community dynamics that are happening in neighborhoods and bring them into the schools, and how incredibly valuable that is for the students, but also how valuable it was for me as a educator to be able to feel a deep sense of place and where I was teaching and living. So I've been following Tambourine and Fans' legacy for a long time, and Talk That Music Talk, the book that I did about brass band music, Tambourine and Fan was a large part of that book. And so Victor's early years with Coach were in that organization. So it was very nice to kind of see that in dialogue.
Yeah.
And his commitment to the children with the back-to-school programs that he does with the Backstreet, and the way that he includes young people in the tradition and always has them as the center of their tribe. You know, there's a lot of amazing artwork, but if you think about, he's doing his suit, and Jack and him are also creating five or six, sometimes more, small suits for all the young people.
A lot of love there.
Yeah.
A lot of love in those photographs, too.
Yeah. They say, like, you know, Jack has said before, we can't get out the door as soon as right. we want because we want to have all the kids ready. And as an educator and someone who has done this with young people for years with bookmaking, I know, like, you do have to take your time and slow down, but you can also achieve really incredible artwork that way as well. And so the intergenerational part of it was important to the Neighborhood Story Project, too. And to have us be in dialogue with each other, to have the archive and the repertoire kind of combined together as a collective body of work is beautiful to me. You know, when we did the Nine Times book in 2006, we coordinated it with their first parade after Hurricane Katrina. And this book, we coordinated with Victor's 53rd year of continuous masking and as a Mardi Gras Indian. And that would make him the longest masking Mardi Gras Indian on record.
Right.
And we wanted to have an event that converged with the social calendar of Mardi Gras Indians, so we did it on St. Joseph's Night and had a beautiful St. Joseph altar ready to welcome the tribe and the whole parade with the Northside Skull and Bone Gang and Million Dollar Baby Dolls and others to the back street. And that's one of the things that I love about doing this work with the Neighborhood Story Project is that the books live in the places
really
and that they dialogue with the performances and the street as a site of art and also of education.
There's a little bit of everything in this book. There are these wonderful photographs, so many great New Orleans voices. And there's one particular poem by Sonny Patterson that describes what it is like to see a big chief. And I wonder if you'd read that, Rachel.
Yes, I'll read it. And I just want to say that in terms of long-term legacies of the Neighborhood Story Project, I looked through thousands of photographs that Jeffrey had because I lived in the 7th Ward for a long time and have done other books with Mardi Gras Indians. I was able to recognize a lot of the people and the dynamic of the moment was and which ones right. were significant. And I saw this photograph of Sonny. And Sonny and I taught together in the Students at the Center program with Jim Randles and Kalamu Yasalam before I started the Neighborhood Story Project. So that's maybe 16 or 17 years ago.
Wow.
And so I've had a pleasure of just seeing her emerge as an amazing poet and educator herself. And I just thought it was beautiful to have this image of her taking a snapshot of Victor.
Right.
And so I said, hey, Sonny, will you write a poem in honor of Victor? And she said, yes. So here it is. We wait with bated breath and high hopes, all to see the chief. Not even a touch, but just a glimpse of his garment, and all will be well. With every stitch, every sacred motion, every holy hymn and chant, we are reminded, those who have gone before are living, are here, are pounding pavement, just like us. And they, too, are steeping in excitement and longing for a glimpse.
Ah, I love that.
You know, I had the honor to play baseball with her father, Charlie P. Patterson. We had that the Sunday league we would play every Sunday. So I played, you know, baseball with her father.
So it's all a story of family and friends.
Yes.
There's this wonderful photograph that Jeffrey took of you getting ready for Mardi Gras Day. And you have your friends around you sewing raffia on your shoulders. And it's like the moment you are getting into the spirit of your suit. Is that how that feels to you, that preparation?
Yeah, well, I guess Jeffrey mainly could talk about that because he's the one always speaking on terms of the spirit.
That's a photograph that I truly love. It's one of my favorite pictures. Some of it was accidental, some of it was not. The chairs in the photograph, the colors that Victor's son and that Jack are wearing, make it, to my eye, look like a Renaissance painting.
Yes.
But the thing that's most distinctive there, which I in particular notice all the time when it's happening, is that Victor does put himself in trance. He doesn't have to think about it. He goes into the spirit. And that photograph happens to capture that moment when you can see on his face the fact that he is going into the spirit, that he's getting ready, the spirit is entering him, and he's feeling it. it's an amazing moment and a lucky thing that a photographer happened to be there to put it down.
Well, this book is full of amazing moments like that. So thanks to all of you for sharing them. We've been talking with Victor Harris of Phi Ai Ai and the Mandingo Warriors, and Rachel Brenlin of the Neighborhood Story Project, and Jeffrey David Ehrenreich of UNO about this gorgeous new book, Fire in the Hole, the spirit work of Phi Ai Ai and the Mandingo Warriors. Thank you all so much.
Thank you for having us.
Phi Ai Ai, Mandingo Warriors. Yeah, from downtown. I want y'all to enjoy yourself and feel like the spirit. She just cut this suit. This is what it's all about. The spirit.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Emily Lee Loomis, Director of Archives and Records for the Archdiocese of New Orleans, discusses the history of the Ursulines at 7, Monday, May 21st, at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Laura Cayouette discusses and signs her new Charlotte Reed mystery, The Haunted Heirloom, Tuesday, May 24th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Walter Stern discusses and signs Race and Education in New Orleans, Creating the Segregated City, 1764 to 1960, Thursday, May 24th at 6 at Octavia Books. Marco Shiro appears in conversation with Daniel Jose Older, discussing his new young adult novel, Anger is a Gift, Friday, May 25th at 6 at Octavia Books. If you're a Walker Percy fan, you want to see photographer Jared Ragland's exhibit called Everything is Going to Be All Right, inspired by the moviegoer. It's on view at the front, 4100 St. Claude Avenue, until early June. One Book, One New Orleans hosts its annual fundraiser, Juleps in June, June 1st at 6 at 1413 Phillips Street, to support One Book and Words in Music. For ticket info, go to onebookonenola.org. You can buy tickets at Eventbrite. Also getting close, June 1st through 3rd is the annual Walker Percy Weekend in West Feliciana Parish, with an additional emphasis this year on the work of Shelby Foote and his long friendship with Percy. Check out walkerpercyweekend.org to buy tickets. The event is headquartered at Conundrum Books in St. Francisville. The Symphony Book Fair is coming up June 1st through 3rd at the Lakefront Arena in New Orleans. Hours are 9 to 8, Friday through Saturday, June 1st through 2nd, and 9 to 4, Sunday, June 3rd. There's an admission fee for a first look Friday from 9 to 3. This is the largest book fair in the South and includes art and music as well. And here at The Reading Life, we're celebrating New Orleans' tricentennial by putting together a list of 300 great books about New Orleans. Send your favorites to labooks at wwno.org and see if they make the list. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press, and the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Engmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org.